Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're undertaking a really significant journey. We're navigating the complex, the vital, and let's be honest, the often misunderstood waters of cardiovascular disease prevention.
That's right. And we're not just skimming the surface here.
No, not at all. We are diving all the way down to the bedrock of clinical practice. And this deep dive, it's been specifically curated for undergraduate nursing students. It's designed to bridge that gap between textbook theory and the messy, nuanced reality of patient care.
It's a pleasure to be here. And you're right, this is a substantial topic. We're looking at a leading cause of global mortality. The stakes, I mean, they really couldn't be higher.
And to guide us, we have quite a stack of source material.
We do. We're drawing from four specific case-based episodes, the extensive European Society of Cardiology Preventative Cardiology Guidelines, and a really critical review paper on the effective implementation of those guidelines.
That sounds like a heavy stack. But our mission today is to make it accessible. More importantly, clinically useful. We're not here to just, you know, recite guidelines or have you memorize tables.
No, the goal is to build a clinically reasoned resource. We want to explore the progression of prevention through the lives of three very distinct patients.
Exactly. We'll start with the apparently healthy adult, then we'll move to a patient navigating complex multimorbidity, and finally, we'll work with a patient in secondary prevention, so after an acute event has already occurred.
And that structure is so crucial. It mirrors the actual trajectory of a nursing career, doesn't it? You will see patients at every single one of these stages.
Without a doubt.
The challenge, and really the reason we're doing this deep dive, is that while cardiovascular diseases remain the number one killer, there is this persistent, frustrating gap between what the evidence tells us we should do and what actually happens in daily practice.
That is the why behind this whole thing. Mm. We have the roadmap, the guidelines, but we aren't always following it.
Exactly. And this is where the nursing role becomes the absolute linchpin. Guidelines do not implement themselves. They just sit on servers or shelves.
Right. It takes a clinician to actually bring them to life.
It does. And we face barriers. Things like limited awareness, the perceived complexity of these massive documents, organizational constraints, patient-specific factors.
The list goes on.
It does. But nurses are the ones performing the structured assessments. They're the ones providing the education, supporting that crucial behavior change, and coordinating the follow-up. If we get the nursing component right, we close that gap.
So let's set the clinical stage properly before we jump into our first case. Our first source, Episode 1, describes cardiovascular disease prevention as both a clinical and a public health priority. The goal is to reduce morbidity, mortality, and importantly, variation in care.
But you mentioned barriers. Let's dig into that for a second. The review paper we're analyzing uses something called the Consolidated Framework for Implementation Research, or CFIR, to categorize them. It's a helpful way to organize the chaos.
So what are these categories?
Well, you have the complexity of the guidelines themselves. They're often seen as too long, too academic. Then you have what's called the inner setting.
That's the workplace.
That's your workplace. Time pressure, not enough staff, maybe even a blame culture that discourages taking that extra 5 minutes to really talk to a patient.
And then, of course, the patient factors themselves.
Exactly. Which is a perfect segue. Our material explicitly states that nurses are central to prevention because they conduct the assessments and support the behavior change. So let's see what this looks like in the real world. We're going to move into our first segment, prevention in the apparently healthy. Let's meet Mark.
Mark. Yeah. Okay. He's a fascinating case because he represents what some call the prevention paradox. He's a 52-year-old office administrator.
And the context of our meeting with him is vital. He's attending a routine health assessment organized by his employer. He isn't there because he feels sick.
Right. He is asymptomatic. He tells the nurse he generally feels well. He rarely goes to the doctor.
Feeling well. That is, I think, the first and biggest trap in cardiovascular medicine. In the early stages of atherosclerosis, that buildup of plaque in the arteries, there are no symptoms.
The plumbing is getting clogged, but the water is still flowing.
So the patient assumes everything is fine. But when we look at Mark's risk factors, the red flags, well, they start to appear pretty quickly.
Okay, let's break down his profile. He smokes approximately 10 cigarettes per day, and he's done that since his early 20s.
So that's over 30 years of exposure. Even at just 10 a day, the cumulative damage to the endothelium, the lining of his blood vessels, is massive.
How so? What is the smoke actually doing?
It's causing inflammation, it's making the blood more likely to clot, and it impairs the ability of the arteries to dilate properly. It's a multi-pronged attack on his vascular system.
He also reports long working hours, a sedentary job, very limited physical activity. His diet relies on convenience foods, and he also reports persistent stress and poor sleep.
And those two, stress and sleep, are so often overlooked, but they are absolutely critical. Chronic stress drives sympathetic nervous system activation, keeping his body in a state of fight or flight,
which raises his blood pressure and heart rate
constantly. And poor sleep impairs metabolic regulation. It throws his hormones out of whack. It's a vicious cycle.
Now let's get to the clinical data. His body mass index is in the overweight category, and here is a critical number. His systolic blood pressure is 148 mmHg. That's a mean of two readings.
And that detail, a mean of two readings, is important for accuracy. You never want to diagnose hypertension on a single reading, but 148 taken twice is consistently elevated. It puts him squarely in the hypertension range.
And his lipid profile. Total cholesterol is 5.8 millimoles per liter. High-density lipoprotein, or HDL cholesterol, is 1.0 millimoles per liter.
Okay.
But here is the key moment in the case, the real teaching moment. When the nurse mentions the blood pressure, Mark is surprised. He says, and I'm quoting directly from the case, "I thought blood pressure only matters once you already have heart problems."
And that quote, that is the entry point for the nurse. It reveals his mental model of disease, which is symptoms equal disease.
If you can't feel it, it isn't real.
Precisely. The clinical reasoning here requires us to understand that this is the prevention before symptoms phase. We are trying to intervene before the damage becomes irreversible, before the first heart attack.
So how do we handle this? The guidelines recommend a very specific approach for apparently healthy adults aged 40 to 69.
We recommend structured cardiovascular risk estimation. We cannot just look at the blood pressure in isolation or the cholesterol. We have to see the whole picture, the total risk.
And the tool for that is SCORE 2.
Correct. SCORE 2. It stands for Systematic Coronary Risk Estimation 2. It's a tool that estimates the 10-year risk of both fatal and non-fatal cardiovascular disease.
Let's unpack the variables, because if you're the student in that clinic, you need to know what data to collect. To use this tool, the nurse needs age, sex, smoking status, systolic blood pressure, and non-HDL cholesterol.
And I want to pause on that last one, non-HDL cholesterol. Note that the lab results in the case gave us total cholesterol and HDL. They didn't list non-HDL.
So does that mean we need to send him back for another blood test?
No, and this is a key learning point for students. You calculate it. It's simple arithmetic. Non-HDL cholesterol is simply total cholesterol minus HDL cholesterol.
So in Mark's case, 5.8 minus 1.8.
Or it equals 4.8 millimoles per liter. That's his non-HDL cholesterol.
And why use non-HDL? Why not just use LDL, the bad cholesterol we always hear about?
That's a great question. Non-HDL is a better marker of risk in this context because it captures all the atherogenic lipoproteins, LDL, VLDL, and others. It gives us a much more complete picture of the bad plaque-forming cholesterol circulating in his blood.
Okay, that makes sense. So we plug these numbers, 52 years old, male, smoker, 148 systolic, 4.8, non-HDL, into the SCORE 2 calculator. Why go through this effort? Why not just say, your blood pressure is high, let's treat it?
Because prevention relies on what the guidelines call a stepwise approach. We need to match the intensity of the treatment to the expected benefit for the patient.
So it's about proportionality.
Exactly. If Mark's overall 10-year risk is, say, low, we might focus purely on lifestyle changes. But if his risk is high or very high, we might need to introduce medication earlier and aim for much stricter targets for his blood pressure and lipids. The SCORE gives us the objective evidence to have that conversation and make that shared decision.
This brings us perfectly to the explicit nursing role. The source material breaks it down into assessment, communication, and intervention.
Right. And assessment is all about accuracy. It's ensuring that blood pressure reading is real, not just a one-off white coat reading. It means conducting a structured assessment of his lifestyle, not just asking, do you eat well, but digging into what he eats, why he eats it, what are the barriers to change.
And communication is about directly addressing that, quote, his misconception.
Yes. The nurse has to translate that abstract risk estimate, that percentage from the calculator, into something meaningful for Mark. You have to explain that his arteries are under constant pressure, like overinflated tires wearing out faster. You have to explain that plaque is slowly building up like rust in a pipe. You have to make the invisible visible to support shared decision making.
And finally, intervention.
Lifestyle interventions are the foundation. They always are. For Mark, smoking cessation is the single most effective thing he can do, period. But we also have to address the blood pressure. And crucially, education has to be paired with follow-up and practical support. You cannot just tell him to stop smoking. You need to help him build a plan to do it.
Okay, let's pause here and pose some reflective prompts for our listeners, based directly on the source material. These are things for you to think about in your own practice.
First one, risk reasoning. Using the SCORE 2 variables we just discussed, age 52, smoker, male, BP 148, non-HDL 4.8, how would you estimate Mark's 10-year risk? Which risk category does he fall into, and which variables are contributing the most?
Second, guideline logic. Why do prevention guidelines recommend this kind of structured risk estimation in asymptomatic adults? Why isn't the eyeball test just looking at him and thinking, he seems okay, not enough?
Third, nursing action. What is the single most important nursing intervention at this stage? And how would you prioritize it based on his estimated risk? Is it smoking, blood pressure, diet?
And fourth, patient perspective. This is the big one. How would you explain Mark's risk to him to directly address his belief that blood pressure only matters after a heart problem develops? How do you change his mind without just scaring him away from the clinic for another 5 years?
That really is the art of primary prevention, isn't it? That conversation.
It is. Now let's move to a different kind of challenge. We're moving into segment two, prevention in complexity. We are leaving Mark, the office administrator, and we are meeting Maria.
And Maria represents a much, much more common scenario in primary care. She is a 68-year-old woman attending for a routine follow-up.
But unlike Mark, she has a significant medical history. She has type 2 diabetes mellitus, chronic kidney disease, and hypertension.
Right. However, she has no history of a myocardial infarction or stroke. So technically, she hasn't had an event. She's still in the realm of primary prevention, but it's a very different kind.
Her presentation, she reports fatigue, reduced activity. She lives alone with limited social support. She has a sedentary routine and says she's unmotivated to prepare balanced meals.
And here is the critical issue, the one that defines her case, adherence. She is prescribed multiple long-term medications. This is polypharmacy. She admits to the nurse that she omits doses because she feels overwhelmed and she's not sure which medicines are the most important.
Okay, so this is a crucial question for our student listeners. We use SCORE 2 for Mark. Do we pull out the SCORE 2 calculator for Maria?
Absolutely not. And this is a vital distinction. It's a point where you have to move beyond the simple algorithm. SCORE 2 is for apparently healthy people. Maria is not apparently healthy. She has conditions that independently and significantly increase her risk to a very high level.
Let's explain the clinical reasoning there. Why do diabetes and chronic kidney disease drive her risk so high that a calculator isn't needed?
It's the combination of metabolic and renal dysfunction. Type 2 diabetes is a potent accelerator of atherosclerosis. High blood sugar directly damages the blood vessels. And chronic kidney disease is a massive independent risk factor. The kidneys and the heart are intimately linked. When kidney function declines, cardiovascular risk just skyrockets.
So calculating a score for her would be redundant.
Worse, it could be misleading. It could actually underestimate her risk. She is automatically in a high or very high risk category simply by having these diagnoses. We don't need a calculator to tell us she is in danger. Our clinical judgment tells us that.
So the guideline approach has to change. It isn't about estimating risk anymore.
It's about managing it. And for Maria, prevention must be individualized. We need to look beyond the numbers. We need to assess her functional status, her frailty, and most importantly, her treatment burden.
Treatment burden, that's a powerful phrase from the source material. What does it mean in practice?
It refers to the workload of being a patient, all the work she has to do to manage her health. Taking all those pills, attending appointments, monitoring her blood sugar, trying to manage her diet. For a 68-year-old living alone with fatigue, this workload can become completely unmanageable.
And that's why she is skipping doses. She isn't being non-compliant.
She's overwhelmed, and that's a critical reframing. So the explicit nursing role here has to shift to holistic assessment.
Which means looking beyond the disease labels.
Exactly. We need to assess her daily life. Can she cook for herself? Can she manage the medication packaging? Who helps her? Does she have anyone?
And adherence support.
We have to investigate why she is overwhelmed. Is it the sheer number of pills? Is it the complexity of the schedule? Is it the cost, the side effects? You have to be a detective.
And then prioritization.
This is key. We might need to simplify her regimen, even if it means not hitting every single guideline target perfectly. It is far better for her to take 3 critical pills consistently than to be prescribed 10 and take none of them correctly.
And regarding patient-centeredness, What about lifestyle advice?
Well, the prevention planning has to focus on interventions that are feasible for her. Telling Maria to start a rigorous new exercise program is just setting her up for failure. We need small, achievable goals, gradual increases in activity, simple meal swaps. For Maria, feasibility trumps theoretical perfection every time.
Okay, let's look at the reflective prompts for Maria's case.
First, risk reasoning. Why is score 2 totally insufficient for Maria? And which factors elevate her risk the most beyond the traditional variables like cholesterol?
Second, guideline logic. How should prevention recommendations be individualized in patients with both diabetes and chronic kidney disease? How do you balance hitting numerical targets with the reality of frailty and treatment burden?
Third, nursing action. What nursing interventions are most important for prioritizing care and supporting self-management in this case? What's your first move?
And fourth, patient perspective. Which barriers, both practical and emotional, might be limiting Maria's adherence? And how could you, as her nurse, begin to address those barriers with her?
Maria really teaches us that medicine isn't just biology, it's biography. We have to treat the person, not just the list of diseases.
Absolutely. Now we have to move to our final clinical stage. The event has happened. This is segment 3, secondary prevention. Meet Joseph.
Joseph is 60 years old. He was recently discharged from the hospital following an acute coronary syndrome, a heart attack.
This was his first cardiovascular event. And the case notes say that before this, he considered himself reasonably healthy and didn't really engage with preventive services.
He might have been a mark who never got that workplace health check.
Could be. Now he's on a whole regimen of medications, lipid-lowering medication, blood pressure therapy, and antiplatelet therapy.
Yeah.
He's also been advised to attend cardiac rehabilitation.
This is standard evidence-based care post-heart attack.
But listen to his mindset. He's anxious, but he says this to the nurse. I understand these tablets are important now, but I do not want to be taking pills for the rest of my life. I feel fine again, so surely I do not need all of this long term.
I feel fine. There it is again. But now the context is literally life or death. This brings us squarely into secondary prevention. The entire goal of care shifts.
How does it shift?
We've moved from preventing a first event to preventing recurrence, progression of the disease, and premature death. The urgency is completely different.
It's immediate.
Immediate and established. After an acute coronary syndrome, the guidelines are strict. The intervention is mandatory, intensive, and sustained. It's not optional.
So no more risk estimation?
None. He is the risk. We don't need to calculate it anymore. We know it's there, and it's very high.
What are the absolute pillars of his therapy?
One, sustained intensive lowering of his LDL cholesterol. The principle is lower is better. We are aggressive with this. Two, evidence-based blood pressure control. And three, antiplatelet therapy.
Why are the antiplatelets so non-negotiable?
To reduce platelet-mediated arterial thrombosis. Basically, to prevent clots from forming on the stent that was likely placed in his artery or in the arteries themselves. Stopping this medication prematurely is incredibly dangerous. It can lead to a catastrophic, often fatal event.
And what about cardiac rehabilitation?
The guidelines give it a strong recommendation. Early participation in a multidisciplinary program with exercise, education, psychological support is proven to improve survival and quality of life.
So the explicit nursing role here becomes education on lifelong care.
You have to directly address his belief that feeling fine means cured. You have to explain, gently but firmly, that the heart attack was a symptom of a chronic disease, atherosclerosis, that is still there. The pills are what's keeping it under control.
And engagement.
Yes. Facilitating that transition to cardiac rehab, calling the program, helping him with the paperwork, overcoming barriers to attendance, and supporting his adherence when he's most vulnerable, right after discharge when everything is new and overwhelming.
Okay, let's reflect on Joseph's case.
One, how does the goal of care shift so dramatically from primary prevention, like with Mark, to secondary prevention with Joseph?
Two, regarding his reluctance to take pills long term, what are the specific life-threatening risks that arise if secondary prevention medication is discontinued prematurely?
And three, how can you, as the nurse, support adherence to his antiplatelet and lipid-lowering therapy in the context of a patient who insists he feels fine?
Three very different patients, three very different stages of prevention. Let's pull this all together now in our final section, segment 4, integrative comparison and implementation.
Okay, let's contrast the core logic across the three cases. For case 1, Mark, the logic is, calculate risk. Use the SCORE 2 tool to identify that invisible elevated risk in an asymptomatic person and justify starting an intervention.
Right. For case 2, Maria, the logic shifts.
It shifts too. Contextualize risk. Numerical scores are insufficient here. Clinical judgment is required to prioritize care amidst the complexity of diabetes, kidney disease, and frailty.
And finally, for case 3, Joseph.
The logic is, move beyond calculation. Risk is established. It's a given. Prevention becomes mandatory, intensive, and lifelong. The focus is purely on preventing the next event.
But knowing all this isn't enough, is it? We come back to that implementation gap. The review paper uses that CFIR framework to explain why these evidence-based approaches don't always happen.
Right. And it breaks down the barriers. You have intervention characteristics. The guidelines are seen as too complex. You have the outer setting sociocultural barriers, lack of insurance reimbursement, fragmented healthcare systems.
Now the inner setting.
Your clinic. Yeah. Time pressure, lack of personnel, maybe a blame culture, or even insufficient IT support to run the risk calculators easily.
And then the human factors, individual characteristics.
That's provider knowledge gaps, but also patient health literacy and motivation. And finally, the process itself, a lack of feedback mechanisms or clear implementation planning.
So given all those barriers, what does the evidence say are the strategies for success? How do we close the gap?
Well, for education, it's not just passive reading. It's things like interactive workshops and academic detailing to improve clinician confidence.
For communication.
Simplified communication. Using layperson versions of guidelines and visual decision aids to improve patient health literacy. Making the risk tangible.
What about technology?
Digital tools. There are apps for risk assessment that can help and tools for self-management support for the patient.
And at the system level.
Organizational support. The review mentions the role of national guideline coordinators, using audit and feedback systems to see how you're doing, and establishing nurse-led clinics to ensure consistent follow-up.
And the common thread through all of this.
Patient engagement. Shared decision-making is the golden thread that runs across all three of our cases, whether it's explaining risk to Mark, prioritizing care for Maria, or negotiating long-term adherence with Joseph.
So really, implementation skill is just as important as the medical knowledge. It's about translating the what, the lipid targets, the blood pressure goals, into the how.
The how of patient understanding, daily routines, and sustained behavior change. That's the perfect synthesis. Effective prevention requires not just the knowledge from the guidelines, but the implementation skill that is at the very heart of the nursing role.
Let's summarize the key takeaways from our deep dive today. First, prevention is a spectrum. It runs from risk calculation in the healthy to managing complexity to preventing recurrence after an event.
Second, nurses are the critical link in that entire chain. You're the one assessing the risk, educating the patients, and supporting that long-term adherence that saves lives.
And third, the guidelines provide the roadmap. But it's your clinical reasoning and your implementation strategies that allow you to navigate the actual terrain with the patient sitting in front of you.
And I'll leave you with a final provocative thought based on the material. Consider the concept of therapeutic inertia. That's the tendency to not start or intensify therapy when it's indicated. So if we know the guidelines and we know the risk, what is the single biggest personal barrier preventing you from initiating that difficult conversation about lifestyle change or medication adherence with a patient like Mark, Maria, or Joseph tomorrow in your own practice?
A powerful question to end on. View every patient interaction as a prevention opportunity. Thank you for listening to this deep dive.
Hmm.